Welcome to the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, we discuss the worsening mental health crisis among many of our children and a medical community ill-equipped to deal with it. Also, the Philadelphia Marathon makes a return this year. We'll hear from race director Kathleen Titus. But to begin, we are awaiting a verdict in the trial of Local 98 union boss John Dougherty and Philadelphia City Councilman Bobby Heenan. The prosecution contends that Dougherty bought Heenan's support in city government with bribes, including a $70,000 annual salary for a no-show job with the union and thousands of dollars worth of tickets to Eagles, Phillies, and college basketball games. In return, Heenan allegedly agreed to exert his influence on the city's licenses and inspections department and critical council deliberations, including those over the soda tax and Comcast's effort to renew its cable franchise agreement. The trial takes place 2 years after a 116-count indictment was brought against Dougherty, Heenan, and several others. And this note, Local 98 represents engineers, camera personnel, editors, and audio and maintenance techs at WHYY. WHYY's Mayor Rindy has been in the courtroom for us, and he joins us now with the latest. Hi, Mayor.
Good morning.
So the jury is back for a fourth day of deliberations. During this process, Mayor, they brought up some legal questions. What have they asked about?
Yeah, so last week they asked the judge to read out to them the legal definition for when campaign contributions can be considered an illegal bribe, because normally they're entirely legal. And the judge explained that there had to be a quid pro quo and so on. That's relevant to certain charges that Heenan faces, not related to Dougherty, but another alleged bribe he supposedly received. And then on Friday, they were read the definition of honest services fraud, which is essentially bribery, but there have to be certain elements that are met in order to prove that a crime occurred.
Describe the scene at the courthouse, both inside and out.
Well, I'd say the courtroom, rather, is about half full right now. And it was pretty full last week because family members came, members of Local 98, a lot of press, because they were expecting the jury to deliver a verdict at any minute. And I think people have gotten a little tired of waiting, so the courtroom's a little emptier now. But everyone's just waiting around.
And tell us about John Dougherty's demeanor and Bobby Heenan's.
You know, for the most part, they're pretty impassive behind their masks in the courtroom, just kind of watching and listening. In the breaks, though, they hang out, they chat with their supporters and their family members and their friends. Most of the time, just kind of quietly watching the testimony take place.
All right. So let's dive into some of the scenarios in which Dougherty allegedly influenced Heenan to exert pressure on city government. The Department of Licenses and Inspections halted some work at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Get into that for us, if you would.
Yeah, so there was an MRI machine being stalled at CHOP. This was back about 6 years ago. And union electricians who happened to be working over there noticed that the people installing the machines were not unionized. They weren't licensed in Philadelphia. They were from out of state. And so Dougherty heard about this and called Heenan and called other people and tried to get the Department of Licenses and Inspections to shut this down. And this is something he would actually do a lot whenever he saw projects being done, any kind of project that he thought were being done by non-union workers. And we've heard a lot about that during the trial. Yeah. And so they did end up getting a stop work order, but the work continued. And then it happened a second time. So the question is, how much was Heenan involved and was it appropriate to call LNI? So that's something that there was a lot of discussion of.
Also, Philadelphia's hard-won soda tax. In the prosecution's version of the story, you've got Dougherty and Heenan in collusion pushing to get the tax passed as retribution against the Teamsters Union.
Yes, there was one phone call we heard many times or heard read many times in which Heenan and Dougherty talk about how angry they are at the Teamsters for running a TV commercial that was critical of Dougherty and for other sort of inter-union movement issues and how they were going to get back at them by passing the soda tax. The defense says that Heenan supported the soda tax long before then, but that's an issue at dispute here.
Yeah, and worth noting, Mayor, the tax, of course, eventually pushed through, has been a win for public health, leading to, I've heard, a drop of nearly 39% in the volume of taxed beverages sold at small retailers in Philly. But the Teamsters represents beverage truck drivers who've likely taken a hit in delivery. So interesting note there. But back to John Daugherty, one of the most powerful union bosses in the area. If you crossed him, he would allegedly punch back. You write of his beef with the Plumbers Union, which didn't support Daugherty's bid to lead the Building and Construction Trades Council. What did Daugherty allegedly ask Councilman Heenan to do here?
So the city was considering updating its plumbing code, and the Plumbers Union was opposed to this because I think they thought there would be less work for union plumbers. And so to get back at the plumbers, Heenan and Daugherty talked about scheduling a hearing on the plumbing code update to advance this plumbing code, but then putting the hearing on hold just so they could sort of pressure the plumbers and have the plumbers under their control. And so that was the alleged scheme. Now, there was never a hearing held. And so that's something that the defense has brought up. But that was the idea they had.
So the prosecution says that Daugherty bribed Heenan to get the work done. Bobby Heenan is a part-time employee of Local 98. The prosecution says it's a no-show job. But the defense says, Heenan is a legitimate employee. What sort of work has he been doing? Do we know?
The councilman's lawyer talked a lot about how Heenan attended meetings of other labor organizations as a representative of Local 98 and would go to political events for candidates endorsed by the union. But according to his chief of staff, Courtney Voss, his Local 98 job was, as she put it, really about politics and managing relationships. So basically making a lot of phone calls. It sounds like he was kind of a political consultant for the union. And the prosecutors, of course, have suggested that he erased the line between doing that work for the union and being a councilman, although he obviously disagrees with that.
Mayor, what did prosecutors provide as evidence during the trial? And were there some, potentially damning moments?
Oh, yeah. Well, there were 53 witnesses, lots of testimony there. A few witnesses talked about a meeting Heenan arranged in his office between Daugherty and Comcast executives where Daugherty supposedly threatened to block the renewal of Comcast's franchise agreement unless the company agreed to hire more union workers. So there's some dispute over the significance of that meeting. A lot of the most compelling material came from the wiretap phone calls. And there's one call where Daugherty is telling someone, we spent $600,000 to get him elected to council so that he could do this kind of thing for us. There's another where a Local 98 official talks about Heenan having a dual role. So there was a lot of very interesting stuff that came out of those phone calls.
What do we know of the relationship between John Daugherty and Bobby Heenan? The defense, portrayed them as almost like brothers.
I don't know if we saw enough of their day-to-day interactions to determine that. On the calls we heard, Daugherty is often sort of taking a boss role and even chides Heenan for not doing what he wants. At other times, though, they're confiding, conferring with each other, more like close friends or colleagues. I mean, clearly they're very close. Daugherty promoted Heenan up through the union hierarchy, and they've known each other for decades.
At the end of the day, defense attorneys contend that a bribery agreement between them would have been nonsensical. What did they mean by that?
Well, the argument essentially is that they're both big labor supporters, and Heenan would have done these things whether he was getting paid or not. And one definition of bribery is that the person has to end up doing something they wouldn't have done or might not have done otherwise. So if they would have done it otherwise, as Heenan supposedly would have, then the bribery doesn't exist. That's something that prosecutors definitely think is not the case, but the defense attorneys have been arguing that a lot.
At one point, a juror was diagnosed with COVID and was removed from the panel. But aside from a brief break, this did not really slow jury deliberations down too much. Mayor Rindy, the jury's work is often done in tight quarters. How has the court attempted to keep jurors safe during deliberations?
Well, after that one juror tested positive, the judge brought in COVID tests for the remaining jurors, and they've been undergoing tests at least every couple days or every few days. He also gave them another large courtroom to deliberate in, so they have room to be seated safely apart from each other. He's also been very firm about requiring everyone in the courtroom to be masked, except for witnesses when they're testifying and the attorneys at certain points.
Okay. Let's talk about some other allegations. Aside from Local 98, Bobby Heenan has been charged with accepting a bribe from a former Philadelphia Parking Authority chair, Joseph Ashdale. What happened here, allegedly?
Ashdale was quite upset about a council resolution that would have asked the city controller to conduct a performance audit of the Philadelphia Parking Authority. He called up Heenan, who's an old friend, asked him to block the resolution. Heenan says, sure. And also, by the way, could you help me get windows for this house of someone I know? Hmm. Ashdale is head of the Windows Installers Union. Turned out the house was owned by Heenan's chief of staff, Courtney Voss, who he was having an affair with. And Ashdale eventually told Heenan he'd pay for the window glass. And this was supposedly in return for Heenan opposing the audit. So that's the alleged bribe and what Ashdale was hoping to get out of it.
Yeah. How many counts are there against Dougherty and against Heenan? Do you have that figure at hand?
I believe it's 11 against Dougherty in this case and 18 against Heenan, because Heenan allegedly took bribes from a couple other people. So there's those set of bribes that are just for him, and then the others are both men have, for the most part.
Yeah. And this is just kind of taking the temperature of the courthouse. Was it expected, Mayor Rindy, that the deliberations would go on as long as they have?
I think this is longer than most court cases take, most deliberations take. You'd expect maybe a day or two. I mean, it was a very complicated case. There's a ton of evidence. There was 6 weeks of testimony and presentations. But it is getting long. Everybody, I think, on both sides and everyone in the courtroom is just hoping that the jurors wrap it up, hopefully today.
Sure. And if there are convictions, what is the potential for prison time?
The maximum sentence both of them could get is 20 years, although there will be a sentencing hearing and they can certainly argue for less time or even no time. And then also at the sentencing, if they're convicted, Heenan would have to give up his council seat and he would lose his government pension.
Okay. Jurors continue their deliberations in the trial involving John Dougherty and City Councilman Bobby Heenan. WHYY reporter Mayor Rindy is on the scene. And Mayor, we're going to be sure we'll be hearing from you today, tomorrow, and et cetera. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, thanks for having me.
All right. Up next on the regional roundup, the pandemic has negatively impacted mental health for kids. Experts say behavioral struggles, depression, and anxiety are becoming more severe and showing up in patients as young as 4 years old. We're joined by Children's Hospital of Philadelphia psychiatrist in chief, Dr. Tammy Benton. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to the Regional Roundup on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The mental health crisis affecting our nation's children and teens has been made worse by the pandemic, and it is increasingly tough for families to find treatment. There's a shortage of care. Too few psychologists, social workers, nurse practitioners, and other professionals are working in this field, and there are waiting lists at numerous residential treatment facilities. Many children suffering severe behavioral crises end up at medical facilities like Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, which are set up for short-term acute treatment, not extended residential therapy. Such immediate care can offer incomplete relief, and often families find themselves caught in a nightmare, stymied by the long wait for residential treatment and unable to care for their children at home. Dr. Tammy Benton is psychiatrist-in-chief and chair of the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And she joins us now on the Regional Roundup. Welcome.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad I could join you this morning.
We're glad to have you with us. Before we get the conversation underway, let's get the number out for our listeners, 888-477-9499, if you'd like to join the conversation. Tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or email us at radiotimes@whyy.org. So, Dr. Benton, you testified before Congress earlier this year and said the pandemic has made the situation worse. What are children experiencing that is driving this mental health crisis?
Yeah, you know, and they're experiencing all the complex circumstances that we as adults experience with much less control. And, you know, the uncertainty about the future and the lack of control has really been a challenge for all of us. So, you know, prior to the pandemic, we were struggling with increased rates of anxiety and depression and more young people and their families seeking services that we were not able to meet their needs. Prior to the pandemic, the average wait for an appointment, regardless of your insurance, was about 50 days. And we were already struggling to see children prior to the pandemic. Once the pandemic began, children lost their structure. They lost their social activities. Families were stressed. For those, many lost their jobs. For those who didn't lose their jobs, they were facing the challenges of maintaining their jobs and trying to homeschool their children. And then school was really challenged because we pivoted very, very quickly to online school. So many schools were unprepared. And we were seeing preschoolers who were doing online learning when those are not the appropriate platforms for young people. So it was just an incredibly hectic, stressful time for children and their families.
You told of being called to the emergency department at CHOP to see a very young child who was threatening suicide, a five-year-old?
Yes, and, you know, I have to say, as surprising as it was to me, it wasn't surprising because it never happens. It was surprising because it's been happening with more frequency. So prior to the pandemic, we did at times see young children, children who were preschool age, coming in for emergency mental health services, some of them presenting with what appear to be symptoms of depression, occasionally suicidal speech. But we saw more of that during the pandemic. So the groups of young people that we frequently see presenting to the emergency department are adolescents, usually middle to older adolescents. During the pandemic, what we started to see was more young children presenting in distress, most of which had to do with changes that had happened in their homes. So their parents had lost work. Parents were stressed. Parents became depressed and struggled with their own mental health conditions. This was especially true if they were experiencing those conditions prior to the pandemic. But even for families who were doing well, they started to deal with a tremendous amount of stress and not able to attend to the needs of their children. Yeah. And then for young children, many times when parents change or they're not as available, they interpret that as being their responsibility. Somehow they have something to do with it. And even though younger children may not wish to be ultimately dead forever, they do know how to do things that can cause harm. So in the case of this particular five-year-old, yeah, she said what we typically hear, which is they can run into traffic, they can hang themselves.
Oh, my goodness.
They can find ways to do things that cause permanent harm, even though permanent harm may not be their intent. And that's what prompted the call. So typically, for a child that age, our staff would not have considered something like a hospitalization for the youngster, but her threat was a real threat.
But Dr. Benton, your challenge was you found yourself unable to provide the appropriate avenue of care for this child. That must have been, as a provider, and as the chief psychiatrist at CHOP, that must have been a really tough moment for you.
It was an extremely tough moment for me. And it occurred at the same time that we were all, as mental health providers, experiencing a tremendous amount of stress, you know, and coping with what was happening with all the young people. So it was, you know, it's part of the struggle of how do you try to keep moving when there's stressful circumstances around you. And then the challenge with this youngster is there were no services available for her and her family. That's occurring more and more often. And the best that I can offer for this family was an opportunity to provide some safety while we tried to address the issues that were stressing the family. And so we hospitalized her at CHOP in a medical bed until we were able to decrease some of the stress that was happening in the family and eventually able to make some connections to provide care. But that actually took a significant amount of time.
And when this happens, a child with an acute medical illness might not have access to the bed. One of the issues is apparently there is a shortage of professional caregivers and, again, residential treatment beds. Let's get into that a little bit. Why is this happening?
So this has been an ongoing problem. This isn't new. We've struggled with having adequate placements for children for some time. We really saw that hit us the hardest back around 2015 and 2016 in Philadelphia when the crisis response center closed. But also around that time, some of the residential treatment programs closed as well. We struggled with the shortage for many years. Many young people were previously sent out of state, but there has been a national movement to decrease the number of kids who are living in what's called congregate care, which they're living in community residential facilities, and an effort to try to reunite children with families, which is a good effort. But there are populations of young people who need longer-term care. The hospital systems that we currently use for psychiatric emergencies, acute inpatient psychiatric facilities, are not prepared to treat children who have much longer-term needs. So, for example, young people who have autism or other developmental disabilities who may be in need of more intensive services won't have their needs met in a brief hospitalization. I think what we're seeing is the long-term impact of not investing enough in the infrastructure for mental health, not investing enough in supporting more providers, you know, not investing enough in educating enough mental health professionals, and not enough reimbursement to motivate organizations to expand those facilities.
So you brought up a number of points there. I'm sorry to interrupt. Not providing enough support for providers. So a lot of these folks, they have debt from going through school, through medical schools, through doctoral programs, et cetera. Address that for us, if you will. Is that a disinclination for them to get into these fields?
Yes. And then following that, even if you make the investment and you get into the field, the reimbursement is so poor that you can't meet your responsibilities. And the end result of that, and this has been occurring for some time, is that many people choose to go into private practice where the reimbursement is better. So currently, in our current mental health structures, to decrease costs, there's been certain arrangements made with some of the payers and the managed care companies where those services are actually separate services from your medical services. So, for example, if you come to CHOP, it's possible that your surgical services are covered by your medical payer, but then there's another whole company that's managing your mental health benefits. And those rates have traditionally been much lower for individual providers. And as a result, they can't necessarily afford to do that. And even if they were interested in working in underserved areas, they do have to make more money to pay back their student loans. This is true across mental health specialists. It's true for child psychiatrists, which is a very small group of providers. For child psychiatrists there in the state of Pennsylvania, there are 25 child psychiatrists per 100,000 young people. But there's also shortages of psychologists, social workers, nurse practitioners, and other community workers who can provide mental health services. And so addressing some of that the infrastructure deficits that we experience could go a long way.
So as far as elected officials are concerned, where do they stand on this, in particular in increasing rates and reimbursement for mental health services?
So I am optimistic. For the first time in my career, I've seen significant bipartisan support at the state and the federal level for addressing the mental health crisis. I think in states across the United States, parents and others and teachers and people who care for kids are bringing these issues forward. And currently there are several bills that have been proposed to address some of the mental health shortages. But I definitely think this has become a focus of national attention with a high level of investment in addressing it.
We are speaking with Tammy Benton, psychiatrist in chief and executive director and chair of the Department of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Earlier, Tammy, you were talking about the fact that even before the pandemic, there was a wait for an appointment even for 50 days of 50 days if a child were in crisis. I mean, what does a family go through in trying to care for this child if they have to wait 50 days to get appropriate treatment?
It's incredibly stressful for families. And I have to say, honestly, it's the thing that keeps me up at night. The concern for the long waits that are available, that are made available to families, we try to address the waits for young people in crisis, even in urgent need. They come to the emergency department because in the emergency department, you can receive some acute care. But what's unfortunately happened for families is as the stress levels continue, they can't wait 50 days for an appointment, nor should they have to wait 50 days for an appointment. So families come to the emergency department to seek care. Unfortunately, you know, it creates another challenge, which is for the kids who actually are in acute crisis, you know, it slows down your care delivery. And for the kids in acute crisis, they end up in the hospital. But the root cause is that when parents need assistance, if they would get the services that they need at the time they requested them, we wouldn't see the need for acute services. You know, primary outpatient care is preventive, and we're looking for other ways to expand that access for parents. So, for example, it takes much less time to get in to see your primary care pediatrician, and we're partnering with the primary care clinicians to be able to provide some of the services that families can receive in their own communities.
Yeah, still not quite enough, though.
It's still not quite enough. Yeah.
Comment from Kate, universal income would help alleviate these mental health struggles because it gives people who are desperate in their lives help with the financial aspects like finding childcare or being able to afford care. Is this part of the conversation, Dr. Tammy Benton, a universal income when you go before Congress, when you speak with state legislators?
So we have actually spoken with asking for any resources that will allow families to have care where they need it, right? So families deserve to have care in their own communities where they live. And so support for school mental health, support for universal child care, universal early education, all the services at points of entry that would allow families access, we're supporting all of those things. So, for example, most children actually receive their mental health services in their schools. And those are places that parents don't have to go to specialized providers, don't have to navigate a whole new system. But all things that support the ability of families to access services they need at any point of entry is what we're supporting with our legislators.
Are those services available in school districts, like the School District of Philadelphia, for instance, which serve many low-income communities? Are they readily available in schools there?
So in many schools, they are. And the city of Philadelphia and others have worked with the schools to expand mental health services in the schools. But unfortunately, with the pandemic, one of the things we experienced is schools closed and all those young people lost their services. Mm. And so those services are available. We're looking to expand them. They clearly need more. And they face the same challenges that we face in specialty or hospital care settings of actually not having enough providers to provide the services that you need. They work it out and they do the best that they can. But for financial reasons, if a school or a community mental health center needs more specialists, they can't necessarily afford that. If they need five child psychiatrists, maybe they can afford one.
Wow.
But the services are available in the schools, but the schools will be the first to tell you that they actually need more.
So from published reports, a third of all children will experience a mental health condition during their lifetimes. Fewer than 20% will receive specialized care. What becomes of those who don't receive the care they need?
So what we do know is that the long-term outcomes for young people with untreated mental health conditions are poor. But that being said, that 20% see subspecialists, you know, the reality is that more young people could be served in other settings than subspecialty settings. So subspecialty care settings really should ideally serve young people who are struggling with more significant mental health conditions. some of the mental health conditions in their early phases, such as anxiety and depression, could actually be treated in the school setting or in the primary care setting or other community settings. If we could catch kids earlier, they wouldn't need all of the subspecialty services. But for that 20% of, you know, the 20% who are treated, those tend to be the people who are in the greatest distress. Yeah. And individuals who have moderate to severe mental health conditions who are not treated tend to have worse outcomes. So, for example, depression can be treated, but if your depression is never treated, it increases your risk for suicide. It increases your risk for school failure. It increases your risk for poor educational and professional opportunities. All of those, you know, impair young people's ability to be productive.
So what are the signs that a child might be heading toward a mental health crisis? What should parents or caregivers look out for?
Parents should look out for significant changes. So I just want to make one statement.
Sure.
Mental health conditions occur on a continuum. So there are young people who have anxiety, and that anxiety drives them to perform better. Those things become pathological or concerning when you start to see a decline in functioning. And so if you had a youngster who was previously doing okay and you notice that they're not spending time with their friends, they're not getting along with their family, they're not doing well in school, and some parents would say, my teens frequently don't get along with their parents. It's not what's normal, it's what changes. Mm. And with those changes, that's when one should be concerned and start to talk to their youngster about what's going on with them.
Be open with them.
Yes.
Yeah. And also then seek the first step, which would be to go to perhaps a mental health counselor at the school or the pediatrician, the child's pediatrician.
That should be the first line. That should be the first line of action. And it's because many times your pediatrician or your school health counselor or others, because, you know, there are counselors at the community recreation centers or your church, they typically know someone else. Sometimes your pediatrician and your school counselor can help you with your problem. If they can't, they'll typically know who they can refer you to. You're always free. If it's urgent and you're worried, call a crisis line or call the emergency department and, you know, ask the questions about what's concerning you.
Tammy Benden, unfortunately, we have to leave it there. Thank you so much for the information, the important information that you passed along to us today. We appreciate you being with us.
Thank you very much.
Tammy Benden is psychiatrist in chief at Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Up next, we talk about the Philadelphia Marathon. Stay tuned.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is the Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. The Philadelphia Marathon was run off the road by COVID last year, but the 26.2-mile Test of Endurance is back live and in person for 2021. It's happening next weekend, along with the half marathon and the Rothman 8K, with a few nods to the pandemic. Runners will need to show proof of vaccination, and virtual events are also being held. But for fans of Philadelphia's grandest foot race, the fact that it's on track to be run through the city is a giant step toward a sense of normalcy. Kathleen Titus is the Philadelphia Marathon's race director and an accomplished athlete. Titus is a marathoner, ultramarathoner, and triathlete who's competed across the U.S. and has run in over 15 countries, and she is a running coach as well. Kathleen Titus, it's a pleasure to have you with us.
Mary, it is a pleasure to be here.
So it must feel great.
It feels amazing.
The marathon will take place as usual in just a handful of days. Tell
it
us
does.
That.
It feels amazing. There are so many people that have been training for this for over 2 years. They were ready to run in 2019 when everything was canceled. And then we get into 2020. You know, we're still, well, they were able to participate in 19, but 2020 when we had to cancel everything. So there's been some pent up anxiety, but we also have a lot of brand new runners that came out of COVID as well.
So what happened there? I'm curious. Did people just get tired of being boxed into their houses or apartments and lace up sneakers?
They did. And some people ran marathons in their apartments. If you watch social media, if you watch the TV, it was just something to do, as people were told they had to quarantine for 2 weeks at home, yeah, or just told to stay home. They were finding unique ways. We've seen backyard marathons. marathons. We've seen balcony marathons, apartment, you know, where people are just going out there seeing how long and how far you have to be indoors. What can they do?
Yeah, so a silver lining to this experience. So tell us about the course and some of the scenery highlights.
So we're excited to keep pretty much everything the same. We did have to change the marathon course and the 8K. Both of those ran along Martin Luther King Boulevard, which by the Art Museum and the Schuylkill River, that is now out of commission to be repaired. So we moved everything to the east side for Kelly Drive. So the Rothman 8K will now take place on the east side. The full marathon will still do most of the course in Center City, starting at Eakins Oval, going through the historic district. They'll go through Chinatown, along Columbus Boulevard on Penn's Landing. They'll come up through South Street. They'll get to see the Liberty Bell before coming out and going along Walnut Street all the way out to University City, where they get to have the colleges cheer for them, making their way into Fairmount Park, then east side of Fairmount Park, where normally they would come down in front of the Art Museum. Instead, they're going to go over the George Street Bridge into the East Park before backtracking and going to Kelly Drive out to Manayunk, which every runner who's done the marathon loves that Manayunk vibe. And then returning back for the finish line. So a little change there. The half marathon remains the same. You start again, Eakins Oval, go out into the historic districts, South Street, come up through Rittenhouse, out to University City before looping over the Girard Street Bridge, east side coming down Kelly Drive to finish. And like I said, the 8K will start and finish on Kelly Drive, which is just a new scenery for those 8K runners who are used to doing MLK.
So and the half and the 8K are Saturday and the marathon's next Sunday.
That is correct. The half marathon starts at 7 a.m. on Saturday. That's pushed back a half hour just to allow for social distancing and some spacing. And then the Rothman 8K starts at 11 a.m., which was pushed back from 10:45. All of those races start 5 minutes sooner for our wheelchairers to go out.
Okay.
So they'll start at 6:55, the wheelchairs, and then the runners will go off at the top of the hour. And then the full marathon starts at 7 with wheelchairs at 6:55.
And everybody has to be vaccinated this year. Tell us about the process.
They do. So everybody had to. The health department's guidelines said, you know, their criteria right now is any event over 1,000 people where they're not seated need to be masked. And unfortunately, you know, runners can't be masked. So we took the policy to make sure that, you know, we followed their guidelines, which was they had to be vaccinated. So everybody is uploading their vaccination cards through our platform called CrowdPass. It's a secure digital online platform, gives you a QR code, allows for simple scanning when you come into the expo. Those who don't wish to upload can come to the expo and show their proof on site, at which time all runners will be given a wristband before they go in and get their bib and their shirt. So process is a little different there, but we still have over 20-some thousand runners. Our maxed out was 23.5. With the deferrals, we've already surpassed that. So, you know, we did have some people that we wanted to allow to defer or, you know, just go virtual. If they became ill, we want everyone to have the opportunity to still participate or at least move into another year to keep everyone safe. Yeah. So we do have those guidelines. They'll show up race morning. They are going to have to show their vaccination wristband. They're going to have to
show
that.
The COVID test doesn't suffice.
It does not.
Yeah. So it makes sense with the vaccination because, as you know, if you've ever run a race, you know, especially if you're among the slower groups, you know, you're elbow to elbow at the beginning with people. You're very close. So you want to have that, you know, comfort of knowing that people are vaccinated.
We do. We do. And everybody else will be masked up. So we have all of our staff, all of our volunteers, everybody else that's out there will be masked up. Runners will have to come into the runner oval. Again, something new this year. We don't have spectators in our runner oval. We only allow runners, so they'll have to have their masks to come in. But the minute they get into their corral, they are allowed to remove those. We understand heart rates go up. People want to warm up. We want them to be as comfortable as possible before the race. So they'll have the opportunity to dispose of those masks, or they can hold on to them. Some people are wearing them at water station stops as they walk up. So everybody, it's for their comfort. We will have masks at the end of the race as well, should somebody have lost theirs or it got sweaty and they just want to have a fresh mask.
Kathleen Titus, for those who've never experienced a race day, there's so much energy. I mean, you spoke a little bit, I guess, of the nerves of people, you know, are happy as well. I mean, I did do the Rothman 8K a few years back with my daughter. We had a late breakfast after the race at a nearby hotel. They let us in. They're very kind, you know, our condition. But it never gets old. It's kind of almost hard to describe for somebody who's never experienced it. Just that electric feeling Whether you're a fast runner or a slow runner or a beginner, it's the same.
It is. And I tell everybody, you know, some people say, oh, I'm not a runner. I'm running, you know, a 14 or 15. I said, everybody feels the same, whether you're an elite runner or a slower runner. When you go out there and you put those miles on, you feel the same. But the energy never gets old. I love what I do. I'm blessed to be out there, and I live for race day to show up. And just to see the different people out there, the energy from start to finish. It's just as exciting to see the runners go off as it is to see them cross the finish line or to do something they've never accomplished before, like when they hit the half marathon point and they've never run a half because they chose to just sign up for a full marathon. Or you see somebody do a challenge where they took on and did the half K, then they turn around and did the 8K, and that's the longest they've ever run. So it's just neat to see all the different shapes and sizes and the cause that people come out for. Our race, our marathon, the AACR Philadelphia Marathon, is to benefit cancer research.
Okay.
And we want to become the largest marathon or event for cancer research. This is our largest year, and it's a pandemic year.
Let's talk about doing an 8K or the half or a full marathon, doing it well. Training. Tell us about that. I mean, if you're, say you're a novice, say you maybe run 3 miles a few times a week, and you've got a friend who's run a marathon, and you say, I want to try that. Where do you even begin? You are a running coach.
I am. Yeah. I say give yourself time. So you're looking at somebody who's experienced runner can start their marathon program 16 weeks out. The part that you layer in when you get into doing challenges, and I've done the 8K, the half, and the full, before even becoming into this, role, and plus I'm an ultra runner, so for me, that was just exciting, and it was something different after the marathon. But, you know, if you start 16 to 18 weeks out, you can build up that base. And the bigger thing is when you do your long training runs back-to-back on a Saturday and a Sunday. So you'll get to feel what it's like to run on tired legs. So often the marathoners are doing this anyway. They're going to do a long run on one day, a short run the other day, you know, and you just look at, okay, how much are you going to do? If it's the 8K and half on one day, then you need to feel comfortable taking a break. You need to understand what your body feels like. If you're doing a two-hour marathon, you're going to be sitting around for 2 or 3 hours. How stiff are you going to be? How to stay warmed up so that you can go back out and do the five miler, which is the 8K 4.97, to do that. And then you have to know what it feels like the next day to do a longer run. So sometimes we'll tell people, you know, go out and do a 10 on Saturday and then do your 20 on Sunday if they're looking to compete on those back-to-back, just to see what it feels like to have fresh legs, to have tired legs. And often we'll say break up some of that on that Saturday.
So good to get into a good program, perhaps even, you know, get in touch with a running coach. And also, as we always tell folks, if you're going to start an intense exercise program, speak to your physician as well.
Absolutely.
Make sure that you are that you can do this and do it safely. So when you actually get to race day after having undergone the appropriate training, one of the key things to remember is don't go out too fast.
Tell everybody that hold back. What's different this year with COVID is we don't have pace groups. And I think there's sometimes an advantage to that because you'll get stuck with a pace group and then mentally that can defeat you if you lose them. Where if you go out and you listen to your body, and most people aren't training with a pace group during those 16 weeks, you might go out and run with a training run just to have company. But really to pace, people are doing that on their own. They're going out at their own time. They're making sure they're hitting their splits that they need to hit, which is their minute mile pace that they need to hit. So I tell everybody, you know, talk to the people in the corral. This is the time to actually make some friends when you come out. Since there aren't pace groups, ask them, what are you looking to run? What's your time? You know, you can make some great friends, but you can also make some great running buddies as you're going along. You might realize, oh, this group's too fast. I tell everybody, hold back. You can run a minute to 2 minutes slower those first couple of miles, the first quarter, then you will the next half, and then save it for the legs for the back end.
You don't want to bonk.
You don't want to bonk. And the glucose level and the glycogen level, you know, for every athlete, no matter what, around 20 miles, whether you're an elite athlete or slower, you're going to start to feel it. The glutes, the hamstrings, those mass muscles are going to start to be depleted. You want to make sure you're hydrated. You want to make sure that you have the right carbohydrate balance so you're fueling properly while you're out there. And this starts days before the race.
Yeah. If bonking, of course, means you just can't go any farther. If you hit the wall, when you hit the wall as a runner, how do you get through that? What do you do mentally, Kathleen?
I have mantras that go through my head, and they change everyone.
Such as?
You know, it's your race, it's your pace. I repeat that constantly. You know, just got to believe one foot in front of the other. I also pick targets out. I'll see somebody running in front of me, and I'm like, all right, 1 mile. And then the biggest thing that I do is I start a countdown backwards. So when I hit mile 20, in my mind, I have 6 miles to go. What's my normal 6 mile training run? Okay, I have 5 miles to go. Okay, that's just from, you know, the house to here. 4 miles. Oh, that's only here to here. Three. I'll sometimes even go into my favorite route or race. I'm like, oh, that's this 5K. Okay, I can do that. So mentally, you just have to figure out what sparks you, whether it's mantras, whether it's envisioning yourself on that normal routine where it's like, oh, I can go out and do this. That's nothing. And you kind of get your headspace in where you are just in your regular training patterns or your favorite race and some of the sceneries that you've seen. You're like, all right, this is right about when I would be here. Okay, I've got that. Or it's picking people out and saying, I'm going to pass them or stay with them.
Some folks who are really diehard will not walk for anything. But I've also heard sometimes it's beneficial to walk. If you find yourself in a tough spot, you can walk through it and then pick up to a jog or a run afterwards.
Absolutely. I tell everybody, I mean, there's professionals, the Galloway method is run walk, where you're going a certain amount of time of running and then a certain amount of time of walking. There's no harm in that. A lot of people will walk the water stops. It's a good chance to get some oxygen back into the muscles. A lot of people's heart rates get into an anaerobic threshold where their body's not getting enough oxygen. So those walk breaks are quite helpful and encourage them. I mean, we have a 16-minute mile pace, 7-hour time limit for the marathon. Most of the people out there are above that. Even if it's a 14-minute, you still can finish this marathon with ease, you know, just by following some simple patterns and knowing you can do it. The whole time, just believe.
What's it like to cross the finish line after a particularly challenging race?
I've had different emotions for all of the races, but it's exhilarating. No matter what, when you cross that finish line, there's different emotions. Sometimes you're running for a different cause. Sometimes it's a new course. Sometimes you realize, oh my gosh, I'm getting a PR. You know, this is my best time. So the emotions for each finish, they vary based on what that day held. If it's tough conditions and you just didn't think you could do it and somehow you did and still met the time that you were looking to meet. So I can say I've had a roller coaster of emotions every time I've crossed the finish line, but every time it's been elation, just to start a journey and to finish the journey and know that, you know, it was successful.
And this is why people get hooked on running.
It is. It's addicting.
Kathleen Titus, I know we're almost a week out here, but the weather at this point looks to be fair with highs in the 50s both days. Pretty good, right?
That is excellent.
So what do you suggest runners wear?
You know, where what the challenge that we have now is we've been so warm. October was our warmest month yet. Yeah. So people were used to wearing next to nothing. And when I say that, shorts, tanks, you know, prepare. Luckily, this week, we're seeing similar temperatures. So now's the time to go out and see how you feel. If you're used to wearing shorts and a top, you might start with a light layer in the morning just to make sure that you're warm. Keep yourself going, and then you might want to drop that at the start line. So you can put a sweatshirt on or something that keeps you, or some leggings for your legs. But if you're used to running in shorts and a t-shirt in 50-degree weather, wear your shorts and t-shirt.
If you drop your gear, I mean, are you assuming you've got a family member who can scoop it up afterwards, right? Or does it just sit there and perhaps go to a charitable organization? What happens with that?
That's exactly what happens. We scoop it up. Well, your family member better be quick. at the start line, we will scoop up all clothing donations and donate that to local charities. If they're dropped on the course, a lot of times a family member, it's something that somebody wants. Otherwise, we find runners tend to leave them closer to a water station stop. They'll stay there until the end just to make sure that someone didn't discard it and wants to pick it back up. So some of them end up in a lost and found until they can be recycled out. Again, if somebody's carrying it for 16, 17 miles, they might want that. They just realize they don't want it right now.
Yeah. So most runners have a traditional night before dinner, which is quite often some sort of pasta. What do you recommend?
I recommend what's good for your body. I'm more of a protein vegetable. I'm a fish vegetable and a carbohydrate. So I'm not a big pasta person. There are a lot of people that are pasta people. However you're fueling your body for your long 20-mile runs, 16, 18-mile runs, fuel that way. Again, don't change anything race weekend. Stick to the plan that you have. Carbohydrates are highly digestible. They're great. Also, make sure that you top off in the morning. Big thing is your dinner at night will only carry you so far into that morning, but know what time you're starting. The race starts at 7, but if you're in a farther back crowd, you might not start till 7:45.
Yeah. Wow.
So start, you know, eat your breakfast, maybe eat a snack the next day that gets you to that 7:45 start, because that's technically your start time.
Yeah, try to get some rest the night before, although it's not always easy.
It's not.
And you'll push through even if you don't.
Yeah, I don't sleep well the night before races because I'm always worried I'm going to, you know, oversleep. Does everything fit? I put everything on. I'm like, I might have worn it 100 times. I'm like, oh, this might fit. feel like a hot spot, and I put something on it to make sure I don't have any irritation. But, you know, you want to sleep well the night before. But, it's, you know, if you don't, hopefully you've rested the nights leading into that night before.
Well, Kathleen Titus, best of luck with the Philadelphia Marathon and et cetera this coming weekend. And have fun. That's what it's all about, right?
Thank you. And we look forward to seeing all the runners, you know, come out there as spectators and families.
Kathleen Titus is the Philadelphia Marathon's race director, and some fitting music to go out on, the theme from Rocky. Our engineer, Diana Martinez, our producer, Paige Murray Bessler. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks for joining us on the Regional Roundup. Be well.